Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm your host, Scott Benjamin.
I'm Ben Bolin. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Kurt Vitamin G. Guerin. How's it going, Kurt?
It's going great. What's up, dudes?
The name stuck. Vitamin G. Vitamin K. There's actually a vitamin K, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah, maybe that's a better one. Maybe we should go with vitamin K.
Was that a drug?
I don't know, maybe.
I like vitamin. Yeah, now, full disclosure, you did come up with vitamin G off air, and I think Kurt and I are both 100% on board. It's just such a cool nickname, and it's tough to make a good nickname.
What about Special K? He could be Special K.
That's the drug.
That's ketamine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it, angel dust? Is that angel dust?
Ketamine.
Wait. Special K is a drug? I thought that was a breakfast cereal. Isn't that right?
Well, it is.
Okay.
It's also a
street Kellogg's
name.
Corn. Kellogg's Corn Flakes. They call that Special K, don't they?
Yeah, it's been confusing a lot of seedy drug dealers.
Oh, boy.
You know, there's some guy in the alley just trying to sell some Kellogg's. And everybody's disappointed.
But it's funny. It's like a tiger. He's got like a bandana on. He's all kind of scruffy looking.
Yeah.
He's kind of like got a hoarse voice. Hasn't been working for a while. No, I'm just kidding. Tony, if you're listening, Mr. Tiger. I'll call him Mr. Tiger.
Yeah.
No disrespect meant.
Yeah.
So are you saying that Special K is like the
That's a
trash
different brand.
Actually, Frosted Flakes?
Is Frosted Flakes Kellogg? Well, whatever.
It is, yeah. Okay. But it's like Special K is the unsweetened version or something.
Yeah, I think you're right. Instead of Frosted Flakes. Yeah, that's right.
Now, before we begin today's episode.
Wait, but this is really important, Ben. We got to figure this out.
I want to advance, I want to air a grievance about cereal in specific and about food products in general. As you know, I'm a very food motivated person, and I still have not gotten that party sub. My girlfriend said it was ridiculous because there are apparently only two of us. I texted her after we did that previous episode. Anyway, here it is. Do you guys remember Raisin Bran?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I was never a fan of Raisin Bran.
Two scoops of raisins.
See, here we go.
Oh.
Here we go.
Am I at the heart of the problem?
Yes.
I had no idea.
You cut to the quick.
Oh, I am so sorry.
No, this is perfect. Yeah, okay. I mean, you're saving us time because we shouldn't be nice about it. Have you ever heard of this thing called shrinkflation?
No, but I've never heard the term, but I think I know what you're getting at.
So there are fewer, like the price of a box of cereal is staying the same, but the amount of cereal you get is dwindling.
But the boxes stay in the same size.
And the boxes stay in the same size.
Okay.
Just like when you see maybe a can of your favorite beverage or something, and you know that the curvature at the bottom of it has increased.
Oh, false bottom.
Yeah.
When
you buy candy bars and you notice that they've literally, like on Cadbury candies, they've literally cut the corners to save 8% of the chocolate that would normally be used in the bar.
All right. I'm trying to think of an example of this. It seems like there was an airline example of this recently. Not recently, I shouldn't say. Gosh, it was decades ago.
Oh, okay.
But when they used to serve in-flight meals. And I think it was something crazy like, you know, by not putting an olive on, you know, whatever the sandwich was, a single olive or a single slice of an olive, this airline saved like $100,000 a year or something. It was some crazy amount of money, but it shows you the scale of what a small change like that can mean to a big company.
There we go. That's right. We are going to segue to what this episode's about. Thank you for letting me complain about this. I've been noticing it more and more. It's one of those things you can't unsee.
Can I make one other food-related comment
right
now?
Always.
I'm looking at you right now.
Yeah.
And you have a Coca-Cola in front of you.
I do.
Right here? Probably bottled right here in Atlanta, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
Not a Coca-Cola commercial, by the way. But what I want to point out is that you are using a paper straw. And I know that's the right thing to do, apparently. Mm. And I'm not on board with this whole thing.
Mm.
The texture bothers me immensely. On those
do you
things.
Need me to put it away?
And they fall apart. No. I'm saying it's not one of those like I am upset by you using it. I just can't use it myself. I feel like they stick to my lips. They just feel weird.
Yeah.
And, like, they just don't feel like a straw is supposed to feel.
So I do tend to use a straw from drinking soda.
Mm-hmm.
However, when this whole plastic straw thing happened, I get it I get it, you know, do your best to make the world a better place and so on. But the thing is that the vast majority of plastic pollution in the ocean is coming from commercial fishing. Mm-hmm. It's not coming from, you know, Johnny or Jane America using a plastic straw when they go to McDonald's. But we at our office now, we only have paper straws. We don't have the flexible straws anymore, which is a shame because
those are fun.
There's a superior straw.
Mm-hmm. Everybody loves the bendy straws, right? I mean, I think so. I think everybody across the board, you know, whether you're young, you're old, you love the bendy straw.
It's so disappointing when you get one and you put it in the wrong way. You know what I mean?
That's a good
and
point.
And then you discover that it was the bendy one too late.
I've done that before. Yeah,
it's worse.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not the worst, but
I've forgotten about the disappointment that leads to.
Yeah, just disappointing. Yeah.
I guess if you did that in like a milkshake or something, that'd be the worst. I mean, you can flip it around if it's in water or something. Fine.
I guess, but we can't be defined by our regrets.
Hey, what do you say we talk about a museum today? How about that?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I've been, as you guys know, I'm increasingly...
Great segue.
Well, yeah, we're 20 minutes into the episode, and maybe we'll talk about some cars today. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe we'll get to it. So I'm increasingly being, now in our current incarnation of car stuff, I'm increasingly finding myself being a on-the-road correspondent.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, that's cool. That's great.
I love being able to do this. I love being able to find these amazing museums, these amazing stories, a lot of stuff, Scott, that you and I have been talking about for years. Mm-hmm. I love being able to go there in person. Recently, I was stranded in Los Angeles due to a series of cartoonish and, in retrospect, hilarious circumstances. And I finally, you know, I did that thing where I was thinking, I'm stuck here. I'm going to be here for a day. I don't have a ton of stuff planned, so I can either just wander the streets, mm-hmm. which I do often, or I could do something productive, which I do less often. So I finally did it. I took you up on your recommendation from years ago, and I went to visit the Peterson Museum.
Fantastic.
Right.
Yeah, and what was your impression the very moment you walked into that museum? Because it does make an impression immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, it hit me before I walked in because I got a sense of the scale of the building. Like we've all seen the pictures, but it didn't really hit me how large the museum actually is.
It has kind of a funky design, doesn't it? I mean, it's like really rounded. It's not squared off in any way. It's a very free form, very organic looking building with there's like red. I think there's a red accent behind it, or that's maybe just lighting that they could change. I don't know. I can't remember, but it's metal on the outside. Very striking building design just as you approach the building. But then when you go inside, mm-hmm. like once you're – and that's the renovated version, which we'll talk about renovation and all that as we go through here because that's part of the history of the building itself, which is I guess I could call it like a semi-historic building, right, in Los Angeles. When you walk in, I mean, you know you're in for something special here at the Peterson Museum.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a lot to take in because when I first walked in, I thought, okay, this will be pretty simple. I can just there's probably like a point A you start at and a point Z you end at or mm-hmm. whatever. But the way the museum is laid out is in terms of rotating exhibits, you know. And some permanent collections. They also have a vault, which we'll explore later, right? Mm-hmm. Which you and I had talked about in the previous episode. But this is, no fooling, one of the largest automotive museums in the world. So this is a museum that you could go back to a few months later and reasonably encounter all new vehicles.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Like, I mean, with the rotation of the other vehicles that we'll talk about, you know, there's several that are rotated in and out, and then they have, you know, other exhibitions that go on at the time. So there's like this endless supply of variety that they can throw out there, you know, that they can kind of mix and match these things together how they would like and put together collections that either make sense or are very eclectic or, you know, whatever they want. And they also bring in, you know, special exhibitions that are, of course, more focused, you know, but only last for a short amount of time. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to go there, you're able to catch those things. But they do have a lot of I guess I'll call them resident vehicles that they can bring in and out that, you know, do live in that vault and that they do throw on the floor. But I would bet that, you know, I went to the museum, 4 years ago, something like that?
Yeah,
it was a while ago.
Yeah.
And you went just recently, but I would bet that you saw very few of the same vehicles that I saw on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. There was, let's see. So they had Hollywood Dream Machines. That was one of their big ones. And that was the one I actually had the most mixed feelings about.
This is like movie cars, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you'll see like some Batmobiles. You'll see some George Barris designs,
which are top notch. I love that topic.
And then they had Disruptors. They had some motorcycle design. They had a lot of racing, like groundbreaking race cars. There's a Bruce Myers exhibit of these epic race cars. There are 10 of them from 1929 to 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stunning. We're talking about historically important cars, like the first production Shelby Cobra from 62.
Cool.
The Greer Black Prudhomme Dragster, mm-hmm. also from 62.
Mm-hmm.
This one won 237 of the 241 races it ran.
Whoa.
Under, you know, driven by Don Prudhomme.
Mm-hmm. The snake.
Yeah.
Snake. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had a Bonneville racer, the 29 Ford 747.
I'm sorry. I'm still laughing at the snake nickname. That's a great nickname to have.
That's a great nickname.
Come on.
It depends on who you are.
Yeah. I guess so. But I figured if you're a drag racer, I mean, that's a cool name.
If you're
to
a drag
have, right?
racer, then you can rationally support being called the snake.
I guess here in the office, I wouldn't want to be called the snake. Like, the, no. Like, oh, there's Scott. He's the sneaky snake.
Yeah. I think it's different when your nickname is inserted between a first and last name as if it were a middle name.
Yeah.
But if you were called Snake, like
yeah.
Snake Garen or Snake Bolin.
That's a good point.
That's a little different.
That's a good point.
You know, maybe. Like Don the Snake Perdome.
Yeah,
sure.
Different than Snake Perdome.
You're right. It is. Like his parents might have named him Snake. Yeah, but you know, you'd always question that. You'd always wonder, unless you asked the man himself.
So I have
And you don't want to ask Snake if that's his real name. You just don't do
you
that.
You just assume.
That's right up there with going like, what's your whole deal? What's your thing about Snake?
Yeah,
exactly.
Chances of him telling you are slim to none.
I don't know, man. Maybe Snake's a good dude. I have a thing with nicknames after a certain I don't want to trample on anyone's right to expression or something, but one time I was on the road and I was hanging out with a friend who lived in town. This was in Nashville, Tennessee, and met an acquaintance of his at the local bar and grill who was well into his 40s or 50s and introduced himself as Snakebite. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to call you Snakebite, man.
Snakebite.
You're like well into adulthood.
Wow.
Snakebite. If I met a 10-year-old who was like, you know, my name's Herman, but I go by Snakebite, I would be like, right on, Snakebite, you know? You conquer the world. But I feel like when you're 50, this has nothing to do with anything.
Did he look like a snake bite guy to you? I mean, can you picture him?
Oh, yeah, he looked like he did some time.
Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
If that's what you're asking.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, maybe that's where he got it. Maybe that's a
the nickname stuck.
Yeah, it's a prison name.
I always heard the rule with prison names was that the more innocuous sounding the name, the more careful you should be around the person.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like if it's Brian.
Or if there's a 7'2" dude named Smurf.
Yeah.
Okay. Like don't mess with Smurf. So I did not get arrested at the Peterson Museum.
Well, good for you.
Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm taking that as a win.
I didn't either.
You did not either.
No.
Now, was this Bruce Meyer exhibit up when you visited?
You're asking a lot of my memory here, but no, I don't think it was. No.
So that was one of the most impressive things, and it's really tempting when you're in one of these museums to get too close, which is why they have the museum minders mm-hmm. there, volunteers and so on.
Yeah.
And it's strange because I'm the guy who wants to look under the vehicle. I want to look inside to see how the seating works out, especially in some of those land speed record vehicles.
Oh, yeah. Like, got to figure out exactly what's going on under the skin of those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's always fascinating.
And that's just one example. We'll get into some other exhibits, but the museum itself has 25 galleries, storing well over 100 vehicles in those galleries, and that's only half of the collection, if that, because in the basement, there is a vault.
Oh, yeah, the vault.
If you pay a little bit extra, or you have some connections, and you're, I don't think they let kids in, I think.
Yeah, 18 or over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you can go and view the vault collection.
And no photographs.
And no photographs.
Which is another tough thing to adhere to, because you'll see some real gems down there. I mean, but they'll all eventually make themselves available on the floor.
They'll cycle out.
Yeah, they will. But you're going to see some stuff down there that are really surprising, interesting, you know, maybe even not fully restored yet if they're working on them, you know, that type of thing. I love seeing that. That's what, remember, we had a conversation a long time, going back to Nashville, I guess, the Lane Motor Museum.
Yeah.
Or just outside of Nashville. And that's one where you can get right around you can get right up to the cars. There's no ropes. Mm-hmm. So as long as you don't touch, you can lean, they even have the windows open on some of them. You can lean your head in if you want, but as long as you're holding yourself back so your belt's not scraping anything, you know, or purse or whatever you carry. But they had a basement tour. And it was fantastic. It was an extra few bucks to go on the tour. And it was some of the best things that I saw of that day were down in the basement still. And I don't know what the thought was behind it, why it was so exciting to see them down there like that. And they're parked just like it's in a parking structure, or even, you know, tighter than that even. You know, so they're very, very close together. And you don't get to see them from all angles or get, you know, as close as you would. But it's just exciting to see them, not even displayed, but to see them parked there like that.
Yeah.
And I know that this one, the Peterson, there have been, you know, a lot of people that write, you know, blogs or, you know, they're online authors that write about, you know, their experiences down in the Peterson vault and, you know, what they've seen, what they have encountered. And I think there was one of Saddam Hussein's cars, I think, was down there at one point.
I believe you're correct.
Like one of those old, really stately-looking Mercedes vehicles, you know, that you can picture a dictator in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a Mercedes limo, but it's like the old diesel, you know, flat hood type vehicle, you know, that's really big, but elegant, but also it now looks very, very dated, you know. But you could definitely picture any kind of dictator riding around in this thing in the back. But they've got some real treasures down there.
It's the 1978 Mercedes-Benz 600.
Yeah. It's probably still there, if I had to guess, unless they auction it off or something, you know.
And this is interesting because these cars especially were mostly used by heads of state.
Oh, that's cool.
They were like the cars of the ruling class.
I can picture that.
Hussein had his until he was overthrown in 2003. The car is not in perfect condition.
No, I would not assume so.
It has some dents in it because guards would sit around on the trunk and their rifle butts would hit the metal.
Is that right? I know I probably shouldn't be laughing at this. It's a dictator's car. But, I mean, you can almost visualize this when you see, especially if you see the car or if you know the car that we're talking about. It just has that look. It just has that old style dictator. This is, you know, the showiest vehicle I could own look. You know, and parade myself through town and, you know, kind of like a show of force, you know.
It reminds me a little bit of that scene in one of those Indiana Jones films where the Nazis are trying to bribe like a Middle Eastern ruler and they have gold and treasure and the guy doesn't care about that because they got him a car. Do you remember that part?
No, I don't remember this.
I got to figure
out. I have to watch the scene, I guess. Yeah, see what car it was. But probably like an old diesel Mercedes or something like that.
It was a nice one, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's just one of the weird vehicles around in the Peterson Museum. One thing that I thought you guys would really enjoy is the 1927 Pedroso. Do you know about this?
I do not.
So
no. Enlighten us.
So here's the story. Back in the 20s, there's this obscenely wealthy Spanish guy, the Marquis de Pedroso, and he's living in France, and he decides he's going to build his own sports car.
Yeah.
So he designs, and he actually does this, he designs a supercharged straight eight, and he implements some pretty forward-thinking innovations, and he gets so excited, again, according to the story, that when he saw the car, when he was getting close to building it and he had a running engine, he just took two wicker seats from his porch and put them on and took off. There are only two that were ever built. The only one that survived is at the Peterson Museum.
He built. I'm surprised there were two built. You know, you'd think it'd be just the one, really.
Yeah. I know. Was it like just a rich man's folly?
Well, that's crazy. So just wicker seats from the front porch. That's
how later they got covered with canvas.
Okay, all right.
When he regained possession of his
wits.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
When Peterson Museum got them, they also received full blueprints of the design. So theoretically, you could build another Pedroso today if you wanted.
Well, I don't think I want to.
Okay, well.
But maybe. I mean, I haven't seen the car, so maybe I'll check it.
Well, don't overcommit yet, because there are a lot of cars. We've got some stuff
to
walk through.
You know, it's not so unusual. I guess wicker for a material isn't all that unusual. We've seen
back
that
in the day, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was lightweight. It was durable. I mean, relatively durable, I should say. But, I mean, just the idea, I guess, of throwing the ones from the porch on into the car, that's strange. I mean,
that's a cool
idea.
Detail.
They're not necessarily secured all that well, I would believe. Probably strapped down, you know, leather straps or whatever.
Yeah.
If that.
But the thing that's different about the thing that's different with wicker specifically is that wicker was used in automotive construction when there were many like custom coach builders. Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've talked about that before. Like the same people who build the furniture are like, all right, yeah, just bring the chassis of the car over.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, I mean, and we see it on even the exterior of vehicles, you know, with laid over with lacquer and things like that for design elements. Some beautiful, beautiful designs come out of that era that, you know, have... it's just stuff you never would see, you know, at this point in time. You'd never see anybody using wicker right now to build, I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, if there is somebody out there, my apologies, but I haven't seen many wicker exteriors on vehicles recently.
Have you? I have not. Not on new vehicles.
No, I wouldn't
say. Not on new vehicles. Now, there is another vehicle I didn't see. I have to say, this is classic Vitamin G right here. Peterson Auto Museum is home to an official Pope Mobile.
Oh,
we did an episode on the Pope Mobile.
Yeah.
We're not... The Vatican technically doesn't like us to call them Pope Mobiles.
Yeah, I'm calling the Pope Mobile.
I mean, I think that's how everybody knows it.
Yeah.
Just like for any Star Wars fans, the name of that tiny Yoda in The Mandalorian is not Baby Yoda, but everybody calls it Baby Yoda.
Of course, yeah. So this is what they want us to call it, like papal transport?
I think so.
Vehicle or
something like that.
Yeah.
Something way less cool.
The PTV.
So this Pope Mobile is a 1998 Cadillac, and this is one of the only examples of one that of a Pope Mobile that was open top constructed on a modern chassis. GM Mexico built it for John Paul II just to use on his trip to give a speech at a stadium in Mexico City.
Does this have the glass box on it?
This does not. And good thing to mention, Scott, because he never actually rode in the Cadillac, there were security concerns about that open design. However, as the manufacturers are quick to point out, the Pope did bless the car on the visit. So it's got his cosign.
Really?
Yeah. And it has that seat mechanism that we talked about in earlier Pope Mobiles.
Yeah.
You know, where, so on several Pope Mobiles, the papal seat, where the actual Pope sits, is on this hydraulic system that can raise or lower the seat.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really neat. I like that.
And that's the ones that have that bulletproof shielding do that, too.
Oh, that is cool. That's a cool feature. I think that's interesting to be able to raise and lower yourself into that box, into that glass box.
See, this is where the dictators need to be humble.
Yeah.
Because no matter how powerful you are as a dictator, I don't think there are people who are building specific cars for you to take a field trip.
You know, I was starting to laugh when you were describing this, when you said that the Pope blessed this vehicle. I got this picture in my head of like George Costanza in Seinfeld, like buying a car that had claimed to have been blessed by the Pope or something. You know, because remember he had, was it John Voight's car, right?
Right.
But
right.
It wasn't the actor John Voight. Remember, it was like that whole thing. Remember, he bought a car that was... I feel like it's one of those moments where I have to say this because I know I have many, many years ago. There used to be a chairman of Chrysler named Bob Eaton, and it was back at the time when my wife and I, at the time, we worked for a company that was like a supplier to Chrysler. It was a television station, and it was like their internal television station. And at the time, we bought a Jeep Cherokee that was owned by a guy named Bob Eaton, but it wasn't the Bob Eaton. So anybody later that didn't know, like past us, you know, past the ownership of us, if they were to trace back the ownership of that vehicle, they might be confused to think that was Bob Eaton's Jeep, which I thought was kind of funny because like, it's somewhere down the line that's going to get confused.
Yeah,
if it's still around. It was like a, you know, 99 Cherokee. It was a red one. If anybody out there knows of this one, watch out for that that fake on the on the auction block, you know, if it happens. But it was not the Bob Eaton. But I always got kind of a chuckle out of that, thinking it was like Costanza's John Voight car.
Is there, I mean, okay, I'm totally unaware of this. I don't know the answer here, but is it legal for a private citizen to own a Pope mobile? I guess it is. It has to
be,
right?
Yeah, sure, why not?
There's no law against it.
One of the popes recently owned, or it still does maybe, owned a Harley Davidson even. He was like, he's a biker.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, so he's got a great big Harley Davidson. I don't know if he still owns it or if it's, I don't remember which pope it was. I don't remember. I just don't have the knowledge.
It's like a Pope cycle.
Yeah. And I'll have to dig into that too. Hey, you know what? One other quick thing.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about the vault.
Yeah.
The vault. Whoops. Not that one. I remember that we had talked about a car called the Dale a long time ago. It was the big hoax car. Remember?
Yeah.
The whole story, the twisted tale of the Dale.
We can't even give away too much.
No.
I think that's a saga, though. Check that out. That's one of the most fascinating episodes we've done.
I loved that episode of car, or those episodes, I should say, of cars.
Sure.
It was so much fun to research that. It was just a blast.
Very strange story.
They at the Peterson, they own one of the Dale cars. So it's probably, if you were able to get down there in the vault, I'm sure that it was down there somewhere. It's one of those cars that I doubt they will ever let go of.
No.
I don't think that they would.
Well, it's certain that no one's going to drive it off.
Yeah, that's one thing that we do know, yeah, that it will never make its way onto LA freeways.
Yeah, not under its own power.
No, not.
What a weird story.
Won't be involved with one of the high-speed chases that we see from the helicopters. You know, it's not going to happen.
There's another really wild car there, too. The 1923 Maython V16 T-Bucket. This engine is insane. The V16, I did not miss... speak, was built in the early 1990s, even though the car is from the 20s. They took two Chevy 350 V8s and joined them together at the crankshaft. There were only two of these engines ever built, and only one was ever installed in a car. And the eggheads at Peterson say, based on what they know about it, it probably produces 550 horsepower, 550 pound-foot of torque. It's a monster, and of course, as you can imagine, that chassis is pretty stretched.
What year was this? 1990, somewhere around there?
1990 is when they customized the engine. The Ford T-Bucket was built in 23.
Yeah, okay. Oh, gotcha. Okay, so it's on that body. But, you know, what's funny, I find this a little bit funny. So they're Frankensteining together a couple of 350 V8s, right? And that's cool. It's a cool thing to do. It's a neat, you know... a neat looking vehicle. I'm sure it has a certain appearance that's really interesting and unique. But think about this: like that was 550 horsepower, and that's a pile of horsepower back then. I mean, it really was. And think about like the first production Viper was somewhere around 400 horsepower. But it seems like a lot of sedans now are around 400 horsepower, you know, or close to it, or, you know, 350 or whatever. And you know, you got some of these. I guess a lot of other performance. You know, lines of cars, you know, like maybe BMWs or Lexus or whoever, you know, that a lot of their top end vehicles are in the 500 some horsepower range right now for production vehicles. So it's funny that, you know, they're doing that. Back then the idea was just go bigger with everything, right? I mean, what a cool design though, to throw it on an old Model T though. And you know what? I think, and unless I'm giving something away here, Ben, there's another Model T that we want to talk about, right? That Mongrel T.
Let's get to it.
You want to? Because this is one of the ones that you brought up in a previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
And almost with disbelief, we looked it up because we couldn't, I can't picture ever seeing this car before, but you had, you've seen it.
So one of the exhibits, one of the rotating exhibits at the Peterson Museum, the time I visited, was that Hollywood Dream Machine exhibit. These are vehicles from science fiction and fantasy. As you said, Scott, movie cars. They've got a DeLorean up there. They've got some stuff from Blade Runner. They've got two vehicles from Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
Which we did an episode on, and they were fascinating to see up close.
They're
very dirty.
Yeah.
And and one of the things that was really the star of the show for me were all these Barris-designed Batmobiles.
Like
Barris-designed, I should say Bat vehicles, because there's a Bat cycle there as well. I guess they decided to go with the Bat cycle instead of the Pope cycle.
Can I stop you for one second?
Please.
Of course. Well, I keep interrupting, but
no, please.
These cars are so cool. The Bat cycle, there's that detachable go-kart in the passenger side, like in the, what do you call that? The sidecar. There's a sidecar that Robin would ride in that had a detachable go-kart that would launch out of the side. That is so cool.
And that thing, I think I sent you guys pictures of it.
Yeah.
That thing, what surprised me is that little go-kart thing is so small that I haven't seen a bunch of the classic Batman episodes, the Adam West era.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like that's, even for such a campy show, that was probably too ridiculous for him to really use it too often. Because you would have to, the best way to describe how you would have to ride that thing is to crouch on your feet and do what they call like the Slavic squat, you know, the Slav squat.
Yeah.
And then take your hands and put them flat on the ground in front of your feet. And that's about your footprint on that go-kart.
But I will tell you, the guy that played Robin, his name is Burt Ward.
Right.
And he was not necessarily tall. He's about 5'8".
Okay.
So he's a smaller guy. But I mean, when you look at him in those old Batman episodes, he's also very thin build. So he's not a very large person. They probably built it knowing that he would be able to do it. I don't think that I could fit on this thing. I'm not much taller than him, but I'm heftier. I'm a bigger person than Burt Ward was when he was in the Batman movies. I'm not slim like that, but maybe it was built knowing that he would be able to accomplish this too. But yeah, you're right. It's nearly an impossible thing to get on. I've seen promotional photos of him in that position that you're talking about, like on the cart, ready to go. I don't remember seeing an episode where he actually used it, though.
I saw a still photograph of him on it at the exhibit.
I think it's probably something that, you know, the movie production company or the movie house sent out as promotional material.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Before we bury the lead, here's why we're talking about this in general.
Sorry, I took us on the wrong path.
No. This is perfect because we're still in the world of Batman, and I did not know this. I'm sure many of our Batman fans in the audience
The
Bat fans, mm-hmm. right? I'm sure you all already have heard of this. But apparently the Joker had an official vehicle of his own, the Joker's answer to the Batmobile. And Catwoman had her own Catmobile.
Uh-huh.
The Jokermobile makes no sense for the Joker to have.
No, it really doesn't. It's an unusual vehicle, for sure.
It's not on brand. It's this mongrel T, heavily customized. We're talking like the seat backs are surfboards.
It's a hot rod Model T that was built in 1966.
Yeah.
And it's so strange. It looks more like something that would be
in Beach Boys film.
Well, you know, and there's a good reason for that, right? I mean, we did then look up the history of this car because we were curious about what happened. And I guess apparently, you can jump in here anytime, Ben, but Paramount Pictures in 1966 got a call looking for a vehicle to go into an Elvis Presley movie. And if you remember, Elvis Presley was doing a lot of like Hawaiian, you know, beach type movies and, you know, a lot of movies at the time. But one of the movies was called Easy Come, Easy Go. And it's like it's a musical comedy type thing. And there's lots of, you know, on the beach type activity going on, you know, surfing, that type of thing. But when that was done, and of course, you know, they designed like what would be like a beach car for the 1960s. I think everybody can picture that, you know, the outlandish colors, you know, the bright reds, greens, yellows, blues, that kind of thing. The seat backs are surfboards that have been, you know, chopped, modified in a way that makes sense for a seat back, and they look like surfboards sticking out of the car. It looks like four surfboards. It's, of course, an open vehicle.
Yeah.
Model T, I think everybody can picture the hot rod version of that. You know, the big engine up front and, you know, open at the top and, you know, big fenders and everything and the fat wheels all around. I guess not too fat, not like the big dragster type ones. But just a cool-looking beach buggy that you would anticipate, you know, being from that era with the beach cars. Well, I guess they just repurposed this thing as the Jokermobile for the Batman TV series, which is really strange to me. Like, why why would Barris of all people, he was building so many cars and like you said, Ben, this is way off brand. It doesn't seem to fit the Joker for me. I mean, I don't know why, but it just doesn't have the right feel to it, does it?
Far be it for me to criticize someone's artistic choice, but it just doesn't feel like a Joker mobile. I think, Kurt, you said it best off air. What were you describing it as?
The fur.
Oh, the fur around the doors looks like the Grinch's fur.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all kind of matted down and dirty, and I know that that's
greenish.
You know, it's time, right? I think it's just time that does that, because I've seen shag carpet that, you know, gets into the same condition after a long time, you know, on old custom vans and things. But this is just like, it's kind of dirty and kind of gross looking right now. But to give it, you know, credit, I guess it's in the basement of a museum. okay. I don't know. There's a lot of tiki design to it. I mean, a lot of, you know, real intricate design on the door panels and
it's creative.
It's got a lot going for it. It's definitely dirty. Yeah, it's creative. It's definitely dirty. And I've seen the car. There's a link to a video where it's, you know, a little bit cleaned up. It's a little bit polished up. And that's probably the way you saw it, Ben.
Yeah.
Some of these photos are a little bit rougher, maybe the way it came into the shop. So it does look a lot better. But I don't know, as far as being a car for the Joker, a good villain vehicle, I don't know if it's a villain's vehicle. Has a happier feel to it, you know?
Yeah.
The Joker's supposed to have that, like, dichotomy, right?
Especially
the character.
The classic Joker in the Adam West Batman is worlds away from, like, the Heath Ledger Joker.
Oh, yeah. Or the one that we just saw recently. Wasn't it the backstory for the Joker?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
The new movie?
I
guess that's pretty dark as well.
Right? Yeah.
How he actually became that person. And it's just, yeah, you're right. It's a completely different character altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, maybe, but it's still, and it just doesn't fit that character very well. It's an oddball piece of the collection. I mean, there's a lot of those, though. You had mentioned other movie cars.
Yeah, DeLorean, Blade Runner. I have to be honest. So that was the only exhibit where I had some, I would say, mixed feelings, because there's nothing wrong with the vehicles per se, but, you know, you get up close and, you know, especially with sci-fi vehicles, you can see like a hovercraft, a glider of some sort. And we know that technology doesn't exist in the real world, right? Mm-hmm. I accept that. We're there to see the design. But then when you get closer and closer, things start to break down and go, oh, that is plywood. You know what I mean?
So you could tell that some are meant to be filmed from far away.
Right.
Others are meant for close-ups, and those are the refined, very carefully put together, you know, well-done ones. That's where, you know, they got the close-ups in the, you know, maybe the person's inside and they're doing, you know, like driving shots or whatever.
Yeah.
But from a distance, these cars don't have to be all that, you know, they just have to have the same general shape. You're going to have somebody different driving them, a stunt driver, whoever, right?
Right.
So that doesn't necessarily matter. I think one of the best examples I've ever seen, but not in person, were some of the Hardcastle McCormick cars, the Coyote. Remember the cool Coyote kit car that they had in that? McCormick, the convict in this whole thing. It's a very improbable setup for the whole.
That's one I haven't thought about.
Drama.
In a while.
Yeah, but it's a great. I used to love to watch that show just for that car, just for the Coyote, because it was so cool. And they had a few that were really well put together, and then they had some that were just piles of garbage. I mean, they were just like they were fiberglass shells, and they were on top of like a really rough frame. But they drove. They ran and drove. But those are the ones they would, you know, jump over hay bales.
Yeah.
And, you know, they weren't so careful with it because they knew that they could build another one quickly. But if you look at, you know, some of the stills from the actual film itself or the television show, you're able to tell, you know, like, okay, this one's really, really rough. You can see the intensity with which they focused on details in some cars versus others that are a little bit more like put together a bit more sloppily, you know, or they're rougher around the edges. So you were there at the museum and you're seeing things like, you know, tack welds, and you really saw plywood on a car. Like you're seeing like it's not metal, it's painted wood. And What about any other like really egregious things that you saw, like any other cars that were standouts for like, you know, this is, I can't even believe this is in here in this museum, but it's part of movie history, right?
Yeah, I just want to keep it. I want to keep it positive.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
Like if anything, to put a positive spin on it, It just shows the craftsmanship and the ingenuity of the people involved in the production, because until you get up close to something like until you get up close to some of these vehicles, and I'm not going to name specific ones, but until you get up close to some of these vehicles, you know, when you see them on the screen, it looks real, you know?
My car's kind of like that now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Nothing terrible. It's just, you know, from a distance, looks pretty good still.
Do you vacuum it?
No, I mean, you know, like, it's just getting older, and there's some dents and dings and things from being in a parking lot. You know,
and
you
from get, your door from your security sitting on the trunk with their rifle butts.
Yeah, with the rifle butts. Yeah, that that always causes a lot of scuffs and dents and things. But no, just, you know, the normal, like, minor flaws that come along with owning a vehicle for a certain amount of time, and you know, you're less pleased with it close up as you are than, you know, it becomes like a 20-foot car. You know, you're happier with it from 20 feet away than you are up close when you're polishing the car and you notice all the flaws and the minor imperfections that are there. But I think a lot of these museum cars are like that too. But there are also many of them here that are pristine. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful examples. And maybe I don't know if I'm going to lead you to something that wasn't there at this time.
Sure.
There were 4 or 5 years ago. On the ground floor, they had a display when I was there of French manufactured cars or built cars, Bugatti, the Talbot, I think, was another one that they had. But they're beautiful, beautiful flowing designs that were painted just like they looked like they had 20 or 30 coats of paint on them, and chrome that was in real decorative, organic flowing, you know, curves and everything. It was just beautiful cars. But that was also when that controversy was going on that, you know, they were going to get rid of kind of the American culture, the South, in particular, the South, Southern California car culture type vehicles, and change the whole thing over to like these French designs because of the new owners of the place. And there was a lot of like back and forth talk about what they were doing because they were selling some cars off, I think, at the time.
Right.
People were worried that they were going to completely convert over to a different type of museum that it was never intended to be.
Like where does the line stop, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they had that history of being kind of like a microcosm of Southern California car culture, you know, through the decades, like everything from the very beginning of the automobile all the way through current day.
Yeah, well, they've definitely expanded their collection, you know, and one of the things that's really impressive and you can see these if you go during the right time, would be all the concept cars they have. You know, like they have a Plymouth Explorer that was built by Ghia. And it was
Plymouth Explorer.
Yeah, it was 1954. This was just a design study for like how would a Plymouth look if this manufacturer built it?
Yeah, and, I like stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's really stylish.
What year was that? 1954. That's interesting. I'm going to have to look that up and see what that was all about. But so they have more than they have other concept vehicles there, of course.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I find like just the eclectic nature of what they have there to be fascinating too. It's like they didn't focus on just one type of vehicle or one. Not that there's a bad thing about this, but when you go to certain museums that have a focus, like it's like the Hot Rod, it's a Hot Rod Museum, or it's a drag racing museum that I went to recently. Like, it's all drag racing cars. They've got a separate building that has, you know, the collection of the owner, you know, that has other stuff. But like one building is strictly just for this type of vehicle. I find it fascinating that they have so many different cars that they can rotate in and out. Like, you know, they have all these different exhibits that they can, again, bring in and out. They're like they have a Porsche collection, you know,
right,
that I guess is pretty exemplary as well. They have, you know, like extensive, as they say, everything from, you know, a 1939 Porsche 64 all the way up through, you know, modern day Porsche as well. They have Japanese automotive industry vehicles there on display, like you know, a huge history of the Japanese automotive industry. So like everything from the beginning to the end of that as well. They have children's race cars that are powered that they can bring out, which I think is, oh, that's a fascinating thing. I'd love to see that display. I don't think I remember seeing any of those, but the powered children's race cars would be a really cool thing because I'm a big go-kart fan anyway. I like that
right.
kind of thing. They have, you know, the Lightning McQueen car from, you know, Pixar
yeah.
Disney cars. Yep, yep. You know, I got a Lightning McQueen shirt on today.
Oh, you do? Yeah, yeah. Wow. You just did kind of like a sort of a Superman
movie. A little Superman movie. I just realized that I had that shirt on today. Gosh, what else do they have? They have the NASCAR Herbie there,
yeah,
which is kind of a unique vehicle. The 1992 Batmobile, of course, that you talked about. They've got, Elvis Presley's Pantera is somewhere there.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that car, that's another one that we just talked about recently. You know how Elvis Presley, he had a lot of cars, a big collection of cars. And the Pantera is one that sometimes will make the rounds, you know, it'll travel and, you know, with like cars of the rock stars or whatever, you know. And I know that it went to the Henry Ford at some point. And you can go see, you know, that there's a bullet hole in the steering wheel from where the king shot the car, apparently when it wouldn't start. And I think the story is that after he shot it, the thing started up. Like, it worked. Like, he threatened it into operating.
That's
right?
The worst thing that could have happened.
It's a strange. There's a whole story behind the Pantera and Elvis Presley. But and you talked about the DeLorean time machine. That's one that I think everybody can picture. There's all kinds of movie cars and cars that were owned by famous people. I know I saw when I was there. There was Fatty Arbuckle's car. He's a big car guy. A big car guy. He's a big everything guy. He's a big fella. Thus the nickname Fatty Arbuckle. But he had cars that were built by Harley Earl. He went to Harley Earl and had three cars made specifically for him by Harley Earl. They were designed and built for him by him. I guess that predates, you know, the days when he worked for GM, of course, and, you know, was full time on the GM design staff. But one other thing about Fatty Arbuckle, he was like I said, he was a big car guy at the time and really loved automobiles. He was one of the first celebrities, one of the first stars to be able to do this, because he was also the first movie star that would make was making on contract over $1 million a year. He's the very first actor to be able to do that.
Wow.
So that's kind of his notch in history. I mean, other than having some, you know, some good films, of course, but apparently a good actor, Mr. Arbuckle. Fatty.
Had some skeletons in his closet.
I was trying to avoid it, but yeah, I don't want to get into that
story.
He's got a whole history there as well, but yeah, some definite skeletons in that closet.
While we're on the subject of things that are turning a bit dark, there's also the 1967 Boot Hill Express hot rod.
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do. I've seen this one. I did get to see this
you
one.
You saw this one?
I did, yeah.
This is nuts. So Ray Farmer built the Boot Hill Express. They took a funeral coach from the 1800s, and they made it a hot rod.
Yeah. Now, you know what? Kurt and I had talked about this on an earlier episode when we did the 70s, or 60s and 70s hot rod cars. It was an actual funeral coach. Wasn't it said to have taken one of the James gang members, I think, to his final resting place?
At Boot Hill Graveyard.
Do you think that's true, or do you think that's a myth?
It's tough to verify.
A lot of this is like tall tale territory, you know, and I wonder. But
and hot rods all have these stories about them.
I like that, though.
I like that
there's a mystery, and I like that, you know, that people can kind of dig into it if they want to and trace it back. That's always fun.
Well, I know it sounds like we're maybe jumping around a little bit. We're doing that because we want to give you a broad view of just how many different unique vehicles there are. In fact, I am probably going to return when I go back to that area of the world, because they have some upcoming exhibits that I want to see. I was thinking about this after we did our famous car collectors episode. I think Scott mentioned James Hetfield of Metallica, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So the James Hetfield collection is coming to the Peterson Museum. He has an entire collection that he's exhibiting in the museum, and it started the opening day is today as we record this.
Oh, no kidding. I'd love to go see that, because I think he was a collector of hot rods, right?
Right,
vintage
yeah.
hot rods and some really old class. I mean, we're talking 1930s iron, that type of era vehicle, that vintage era.
I think it's a one-day thing.
Oh, boy. Well, you know what? That's too bad. Well, gosh, if you're listening to this episode live, which I know you're not, otherwise, I just missed out on the Hetfield collection, but I'm sure there's plenty of other collections to go to and check out. That's the one thing too. I mean, you go to their website. They've always got you up to date on what's coming in, what's leaving, you know, the dates of the shows and everything. So if you're in the area of, you know, the Peterson, definitely worthwhile. It's not really that expensive to go. It's relatively a cheap afternoon. But man, there's so many beautiful, beautiful vehicles there. It really is a different type of museum altogether.
Yeah. Highly recommended. Now, I'm not going to start saying one museum is better than another, since I feel like I'll be on the road for a lot of these.
Yeah.
But it is very different from the Nagoya Museum. And if you go to the Peterson Museum, be aware that, like the natural history museums or the Smithsonian's, this is at the very least a full day visit. Don't go in at like 4:30 thinking you're going to run through it.
No. This is a long afternoon or a full day. And
absolutely,
maybe even, like you said, you can go back and check it out. Now, it's funny that you say Natural History Museum, because that's where this whole thing started, really. I mean, we didn't talk about this, but I just want to mention it, because I think there's one thing in here that's really interesting, I think, out of this whole thing. I mean, maybe you can take pieces of this and, you know, that's the most interesting thing to you, but the purchase price of the building was one of the most interesting things to me out of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So the building itself, I think it was like, I want to say it was the 1960s. It was opened in 1962 as a branch of a department store, I believe, right?
Cebu.
Yes, Cebu. It was a department store back then. And then another department store bought it from around, what was it, 1965? And they owned it until 1986. And I think it was called Orbox. So it was an Orbox department store then after that point, so from 65 to 86. And then after that, I mean, after, I guess, Peterson, who, by the way, I mean, we didn't even say this. Peterson is a publishing magnate. He's the guy that was in charge of magazines like Hot Rod and Motor Trend and Motorcyclist. And he also had some other stuff like Tiger Beat and Teen Magazine and Sassy Magazine.
He has a really compelling story, just real briefly on him. If we could do his background, is that all right?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Sure. And then I'll get back to the building.
Okay, so Robert Peterson was born in 1926, and he was a bootstraps guy. His father was a truck mechanic, which gave him that lifelong love of cars. He's a veteran. He served in the Army Air Corps, and he went to work as a publicist at MGM, and he got laid off, which launched him into his creating his own business with some other people who got laid off at MGM. And that set him on the path to becoming the publisher of all these profoundly influential auto magazines. And it also gave him, frankly, the scratch he needed to create his own car collection and then to create this automotive museum. So in a weird way, thanks for being jerks, MGM.
Yeah, and what's the old saying? I mean, every door that closes gets the worm or something like that, right? That's it, right?
I learned the word for, oh man, I thought of you guys, for the blending of idioms or cliches.
Oh, this is my problem, right? This is my diagnosis.
I think it's your gift.
No.
It's called a malaphor.
A malaphor. Okay.
So like, we'll burn that bridge when we get to it.
Oh, okay.
Or
that makes perfect sense.
It's not rocket surgery.
Well, when you say them, they're ridiculous. That's crazy. But to me, they make perfect sense.
You've opened this can of worms. Now lie in it. These are great.
You know who did this? And now I remember. It was in Back to the Future. It was
Biff.
Was it Biff? Yeah. You're right, Kurt. It was Biff. Biff was always mixing up those sayings, and it was so funny. But I do that myself now. Like, I can't get them straight.
I don't think it's a bit either, dude. I believe you.
I cannot get those straight. I mean, there's some that I get, but others I just can't remember. And like, it's like, funny because like, I've already started saying it, and then I just have to finish it with whatever I can think of at the moment. You know, I know how to use it. I just can't get the right words out.
You always nail the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, it's used in the right context. But then it's the closing part that I have, the wrap up, you know,
I can't,
the punchline.
There have been so many, man, that I sometimes can't remember whether you actually said one or whether I thought of something that sounded like it would be like a Scott Benjamin style observation. Yeah. There's stuff like, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but there are two in the bush. Stuff like that, yeah, you know?
And yeah, it's all
that's
strange.
Malaphor.
Yeah. Malaphor. Okay, very good. Very good. So he, yeah. Anyway, so Peterson.
Peterson.
He's moved on from his job. Yeah, he's laid off or whatever. And now he's suddenly thrust into the world of publishing, or he wants to be a publisher, right?
Right. Okay. Right.
And that's where he made his fortune.
And that's why we have to, in a weird way, thank MGM. And now that we know Peterson, back to the building. We kind of did this episode backwards, didn't we?
I guess so. You know, maybe it was a, well, who's the actor? Tarantino. Piece things together like this, right? Maybe that's maybe we should give him a co-credit on this.
Maybe this will be our first non-linear podcast. Actually, it probably wouldn't be.
But, no, we do this all the time. We talk about crap. It doesn't matter.
Kurt, are you going to edit this in so we start like in media res?
No, this makes sense.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you're too kind.
I don't know about that. We'll have to ask listeners if any of this makes sense.
Oh, gosh.
All right, so back to the building.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Also, on a serious note, if there are any complaints, we do want to hear from you, the good stuff as well as the bad stuff. So we're grateful whenever you take the time to contact us. We have a special email for any complaints. You can write directly to our complaint department, which is jonathanstrickland@iheartradio.com. 24/7,
yeah,
365 days a week,
yep,
days a year. I mean, so he's going to kill us.
Can be as mean as you want.
Yeah, please. Please let it rip.
Just let us have it.
Yeah.
Let us have it.
Unvarnished truth. Again, only to that email address. Feel free to send multiple times if you're worried it didn't come through.
I love this part of the show.
Me too.
All right.
Oh, okay. This building, though.
Back to the building. Okay. So we're in 1986. And I guess 6 years later, Robert Peterson decides that he is going to, he's looking for property for a museum for his interest in automobiles. He's got all his money, right? He decides that he's going to open a museum, and he's trying to find an ideal space, and he decides that this is a great building for it, this department store, because it has very few windows. The place doesn't have, it's not like completely open like a lot of the other buildings downtown were, and decided that this would be a great place to have, you know, artifacts, you know, like without any kind of direct exposure to sunlight, so, you know, like it doesn't have to worry about sun fade on, you know, whether it's automobiles, interiors, or paintings, or whatever he happens to put up in there, and decides that he's going to buy this building. And he buys the building in 1992 for an odd sum. This is what I find interesting about this whole thing. I mean, there's a lot interesting, but this number, he buys it in 1992 for, it's all ones, completely ones, $11,111,111.11. So all ones, all the way across. It's a very easy number to remember, but he buys the building in 1992 from that department store, Orbach's, and in 1994, he opens up the museum, the first iteration of the Peterson Museum, and a much different version than you and I have seen. It was still nice. It was just different. And the renovation that they went through recently, they went through in 2015 and did this $125 million renovation, where, as we said, you know, they've done not only the inside the museum, but they've also done the outside of the museum, where it's this kind of, and here's a better way to describe it, I found it finally, a stainless steel ribbon assembly that's made of 100 tons of 14-gauge type 304 steel in 308 sections. And it has something like 140,000 custom stainless steel screws that keep the thing in place. It's really an interesting looking building. It stands out in downtown LA, of course. And it's inside and out, this is a unique experience, really. It's the building itself has got its own history. The materials inside, the person who owns it, or who owned it, I should say, he has passed on. He passed away, I believe, in 2007, wasn't it? I think that's when Peterson, 2007, he was age 80 when he died. But of course, the place is still operating and doing well, as you said. Mm-hmm. It's a great place to go, and as you've mentioned, spend more than a day there if you can, or a day.
Yeah,
you know, it's tough to spend more than a day, but if you can spend a day there, I'd say you're getting your money's worth out of the museum for sure.
And the museum itself is a celebrity in its own right.
Yeah,
it has its own history as a building, as you mentioned. Adam Carolla held his 10th anniversary celebration for his podcast there, So maybe we can do a live podcast at the Peterson Museum one day. It is involved in the death of the notorious B.I.G.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the last place he was seen alive, right?
Right. And the building's featured in a couple of films, Miracle Mile, Volcano, mm-hmm. Who Killed the Electric Car.
Sure.
So check it out.
Oh, yeah. Who Killed the Electric Car? That's the EV was there, right? It was in the museum. What was it? There was a strange story.
Someone who owned GM EV1 goes to visit their car.
Yeah, that's right, because they had to return the vehicles, right?
Right.
They had to give them back to GM, and the one that person in particular owned or rented was on display at the Peterson Museum.
That's still the EV1 story for another day, but that's still so strange.
It is.
But let us know what exhibits you saw at the Peterson Museum, because odds are the average person has not seen all of the exhibits, nor probably all of the vehicles.
No, unless you work there, you wouldn't have been privy to see every single one of them, or know exactly what's coming up when. So it'd be a fascinating place to work, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, really dream cool. job. Our gig's okay, but dream job would be working at an auto museum, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. That would be fun. Yeah. I don't know. You know what? I waffle on this a little bit, because I think it'd be really cool to work in a museum, an automobile museum. It'd be fun to be surrounded by that. But, I mean, after about a day or two, I don't know. Unless you're really taking deep dives into the history of a certain car and you really focus on that and then move on to the next one, I think that it would just become a bit repetitive for me.
See, this is why you want to get the perfect job, which is either the test driver or the restorer.
Oh, yeah. If you're a mechanic there, that'd be great.
Yeah.
That would be fun. But test driver, that's an interesting idea, too. If you were able to, actually, take them out and motor them around a little bit, stretch their legs, that'd be fun.
I think you have to earn that, though. I don't think they let you. I don't think, on the website they have, cashier, cafe position, test driver.
Yeah. Some of the docents at the Lane Museum, the one that I mentioned earlier, I know that I was talking to one of them for a long time, and just kind of our paths crossed many times, during the museum tour there. He was very helpful. He said that, he does get to take vehicles home, because that's one of the pride of a lot of museums is that, just in particular the Lane Museum, every vehicle is roadworthy. So they encourage their employees to take them home sometimes and, just kind of work them out a little bit, because it's good for a car to move it. It's bad for them to sit around. So they realize that. And, I'm sure that there are limitations. There's certain vehicles there that they're not allowed to bring home, like, the rally cars and things like, the Group B rally cars that show up, or vehicles like that are not, road legal, of course.
And that's why you refused to volunteer there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Road rally or nothing.
If I'm not taking a Group B rally car home, I'm not doing it.
One important note regarding these museums and this travel. So now that I am officially a on-the-road consultant for car stuff, there are going to be times where I'm out of the studio because I'm on some weird mission, and we would love your help. Recommend some of your favorite museums in your neck of the global woods, some of your favorite car events, racetracks, no spoilers, but we're working on getting car stuff itself back on the road,
Oh, yeah.
And we would love to hear your recommendations. So let us know. You can let us know on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We mentioned in this episode, a lot of stuff that we had recorded previously, like the Dale car, a couple other stories. If you want to check those out, you can find our podcast. Just point your browser to carstuffshow.com, right? You go to our website, and you can find us on anywhere you get podcasts. Just know that I think it's Apple Podcasts that only shows you the first 300.
That's correct. If you want the full archive, you have to go to iHeartRadio, the iHeartRadio app, I guess, or iHeartRadio.com, and check that out there. But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I think we've got to be getting close to 1,000.
No way.
Well, it may be a little ways off because, we're once a week at this point, so.
Yeah, well, if we plan this right, you guys, we could get a party sub. Ooh. For episode 1,000.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. That'd be fantastic.
I mean, dare to dream.
Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.